Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, it was 4 years in the making, but is the recently passed energy bill worth the wait? Most of the media coverage seemed to split the difference between the good and the not so good. But what else should we know? Winona Halder of Public Citizen will join us with her take. Also on the program, if you're only looking at the country's major media, you likely know nothing at all about bills currently before Congress that would allow cable companies to offload those pesky public access requirements that are supposed to be part of their lucrative franchise agreements. We'll hear more about these latest attempts by corporate media to profit from the public while shutting them out from Anthony Riddle, Executive Director of the Alliance for Community Media. But first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press.
Cindy Sheehan's son Casey died in the Iraq War last year, and since then she's spoken out passionately against that war. When George W. Bush decided to spend a month at his Texas ranch, Sheehan decided to join him, camping outside and demanding a face-to-face meeting. One of the curious things about this has been how the press corps explains why they're now paying attention to Sheehan's story. The New York Times on August 8th acknowledged that anti-war protesters don't usually get so much ink, and the paper offered several explanations for the exception. First, 20 Marines died the previous week. Except service people have been dying every week. Then, polls show support for the war declining. Except public dissatisfaction with the war isn't new either. Finally, the Times offers another reason. Sheehan is, quote, at the doorstep of the White House press corps, which spends each August in Crawford with little to do, minimal access to Mr. Bush and his aides, and an eagerness for any new story, close quote. That last rationale, which says more about the laziness of the press corps than anything else, has the ring of truth, unfortunately. As Sheehan explained to the Wall Street Journal, her other anti-war actions haven't been so widely covered. When she protested in Washington, D.C., for example, where you might think journalists would also be eager for stories, she got just a few phone calls. Well, to no one's surprise, the Fox News Channel has a decidedly different take on the story. Sheehan's been mentioned there sporadically and only in a negative light. Fox blowhard Bill O'Reilly argued that while Sheehan's, quote, entitled to her opinion, close quote, Americans should know that she's hanging around with anti-war radicals. O'Reilly claimed to be most worried about other military families who might, quote, feel that this kind of behavior borders on treasonous, close quote. Viewers too put off by that to keep watching would have missed O'Reilly's guest that night, right-wing pundit Michelle Malkin, who added a grotesque twist, saying that Sheehan's dead son would certainly not approve of his mother. The only question left for viewers was, how low can these people go?
The Washington Post ran a big story August 7th, page one, above the fold, with the alarming headline, Terrorists Turn to Web as Base of Operations. Statements about how, quote, the web's shapeless disregard for national boundaries and ethnic markers fits exactly with bin Laden's original vision for Al-Qaeda, close quote, suggest a story with more color than substance. But the article's A1 placement conveys that the Post would like us to take very seriously its conclusions, that what's called the global jihad movement has now become a web-directed phenomenon, and that the very nature of the internet makes it hard for the U.S. government to counter this, quote, vast online presence, close quote. Among other things, the piece contends, quote, Al-Qaeda and its offshoots are building a massive and dynamic online library of training materials, close quote. And the Post offered sample documents from this library on its own website. But, according to Secrecy News, a publication of the Federation of American Scientists, the materials the Post presents actually indicate something nearly the opposite of what the article is trying to show. One of the documents was something called the Mujahideen Poisons Handbook, which was purported to explain how to manufacture betaluminium poison. Except, as Secrecy News points out, there is no such thing. The word appears to be a corruption of botulinum. and the method the handbook offers for producing it would yield nothing of the kind. Indeed, the chemist consulted by Secrecy News concluded that the handbook seemed to him to be a hoax, a document seemingly the work of someone, quote, profoundly ignorant of the nature of simple compounds and incompetent in even minor laboratory procedures, close quote. In other words, if it is indeed representative of jihadists' massive and dynamic online library of training materials, that's good news for public safety and security. Secrecy News adds that readers might have been tipped to the fact that the Post reporters were in over their heads, scientifically speaking, when they refer early on in the article to the virus that causes pneumonic plague. Pneumonic plague is caused by a bacterium, not a virus. Perhaps the Post simply figured that any story with terrorism plus the internet just added up to front page news. One would hope they would throw a little fact-checking into the mix, too.
Can Condi Rice save Iraq? That's actually the question posed on the cover of the August 15th issue of Time magazine. So it's not too surprising to find that the story inside sidesteps any serious criticisms or questions about Rice, especially on the Iraq War, which the magazine states she has, quote, inherited responsibility for cleaning up, close quote. Rice's previous job, as far as we can recall, was National Security Advisor. As such, she was a key part of the Bush team that sold the country on going to war, with Rice herself making the case in numerous TV appearances. It's puzzling that the magazine would say Rice inherited a problem she helped create. But that sort of argument is consistent with the rest of the piece, which presents no critics of Rice or of the direction of U.S. foreign policy. There is, however, plenty of room to praise Rice. We learn that she doesn't, quote, hide her confidence about making history, close quote. She's a glamorous, globe-trotting operator who can play tough, and that her, quote, most appealing qualities are her optimism and belief in the power of American ideals, close quote. Time also noted that, quote, Rice's admirers point to her intellect and perfectionist drive and conclude that if anyone can figure out what to do in Iraq, it's Rice, close quote. Too bad Rice's admirers are the only people Time thought to include in their article about her.
On August 8th, Walmart asked a federal appeals court to break up the largest class action suit in U.S. history, in which plaintiffs representing over 1 million workers accuse Walmart of sex discrimination. In addition to being the world's largest retailer, Walmart also spends considerable money advertising on mainstream media outlets, like ABC. The discount giant sponsors the Person of the Week segment on ABC's World News Tonight. They regularly air commercials during ABC newscasts, and they sponsor the Only in America series on ABC's Good Morning America. So how did ABC's nightly newscast handle the news of Walmart's court battle? In an August 7th preview, reporter Jeff Morrell called it the biggest civil rights case ever and quoted plaintiff Chris Kwapnoski. But then ABC lined up three sources to criticize the case, starting with Walmart CEO Lee Scott. His comments were echoed by a spokesperson from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce who called the suit fundamentally unfair. Morrell then mentioned that, quote, economists say that could have a chilling effect on big retailers, forcing them to raise prices and implement stricter policies for promotion, close quote. To back up that point, the broadcast quoted Tim Kaine of the Right-Wing Heritage Foundation, hardly representative of all economists. No experts or advocates in the segment spoke on behalf of the plaintiffs, aside from Kwapnoski herself. And her credibility was undercut by ABC's Morrell, who said, quote, ironically, Chris Kwapnoski was promoted 3 days after filing her suit, close quote. The idea that this timely promotion was not irony but strategy on the part of Walmart was not considered. Given its lucrative relationship with Walmart, ABC segments like this one only contribute to a suspicion that Walmart's sponsorship of the news comes at a steep price, specifically for ABC viewers who want to know more about the company than what the company's PR campaign tells them.
And finally, listeners will likely know that ABC's Peter Jennings has died from lung cancer at the age of 67. While Fair was frequently critical of World News Tonight under his tenure, Jennings did distinguish himself among television talking heads by his apparent intelligence and decency. One small example, when Fair organized a protest march against the jingoistic coverage of the Gulf War in 1991, leading crowds of demonstrators to the headquarters of the major broadcast networks, only one major media figure came came down to hear what the protesters had to say. Recalled longtime media activist Steve Rhodes, quote, Peter Jennings came out with his notebook to cover it. Most people just sort of shouted at him, but he said he was just there to listen, close quote. Sad to say, that's a trait that's all too rare among the media elite.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
The long struggle to pass an energy bill ended this month as George W. Bush took a break from his vacation to sign the bill into law. Many in the media couldn't think of much good to say about it, but the criticism wasn't exactly overpowering either. So what might be lurking in this energy bill? And what explains the somewhat blasé response from the national press? We're joined now by Winona Howder. She's director of the Critical Mass Energy and Environment Program at Public Citizen. Winona, welcome back to Counterspin.
Glad to be here.
Well, here's how the New York Times led its story on that bill signing ceremony. Quote, on a day when oil and gasoline prices hit record highs, President Bush on Monday signed into law a bill that encourages increased domestic oil and gas production and the building of new nuclear power plants. Close quote. Well, that's as good a place to start as any. What does the energy bill have to do with oil and gas prices?
Well, it certainly doesn't have anything good to do with oil and gas prices. It's not going to lower costs at the pump for consumers. And if anything, we'll probably see higher prices for gasoline and also for electricity consumers. I mean, this was a 1,726-page bill, and we really shouldn't have called it the Energy Bill. It should have been the Polluters and Plunderers Profiteering Act.
Well, there is this sort of, on the one hand, on the other hand, approach to the bill in much of the media coverage. The front page of the USA Today on July 29th had a winners and losers chart. The winners were ethanol, coal, and automakers. The losers were oil and gas and environmentalists. It's sort of unhelpful to anyone trying to figure this out. What are the provisions in this bill that you think so far have kind of escaped media scrutiny?
Well, you know, I think it's pretty interesting that they say the oil companies are losers because that's simply not true. The oil industry got about $3 billion in tax breaks and subsidies, and the natural gas industry got another $1 billion, but they got all sorts of other benefits. They don't have to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act when they do underground injection of chemicals when they're drilling. They don't have to comply with the Clean Water Act when they're doing construction activities and drilling. It also has all sorts of dire consequences for our coastlines because it's going to allow harmful underwater oil and gas exploration that could pave the way for a lot of offshore drilling. And it also seeks to exclude many of the things that the oil and gas industry do in terms of exploration and drilling. They'll be exempted from impact analysis under the National Environmental Policy Act. And, you know, that's the most important environmental protection act in the country. And being exempted from that will mean major environmental damage, and it will also mean heavy profits for the industry. So I would hardly say that the oil company is a loser. I mean, I guess the other thing that I would want to really mention that has gotten almost no coverage is the real effect that repealing the Public Utility Holding Company Act is going to have. This is a law that is a consumer protection law for electricity rates. Most consumers don't even know that it exists because it was passed in 1935. This is going to really turn the clock back to the 1920s in terms of electricity regulation and electricity rates. We're going to see a massive consolidation in the utility and power plant industry, and that does not lead to any competition. And it also means that oil companies, banks, and even foreign governments may be buying electric companies, which moves them even further from local control, any state oversight or accountability. You know, we didn't see the kind of coverage of the really dire things in this bill before its passage. I mean, there were editorials, to be fair, in the elite press, the Post, the Times, saying that the energy bill was bad. But as far as the news coverage and really doing the kind of everyday coverage, you know, the kind of coverage that they did in the Monica Lewinsky case of talking about the real consequences to people's lives, it just simply wasn't done. We did see some fairly good stories the day after it passes. Well, you know, it's too late then. So we would much rather have seen some hard-nosed coverage before the bill passed. And we would like to have seen campaign contributions and the role that the energy companies played in passing this bill, because we're basically talking about public policy for sale.
Now, his name doesn't come up in much of the coverage, but didn't the early versions of this bill, we've been talking about this, I think, for 4 years, didn't the early versions come out of those famous Cheney Energy Task Force meetings, the notes of which are still secret?
Absolutely. This bill was written by the Cheney Task Force. It was written by the energy company for the energy companies, and there hasn't been the kind of notice or discussion of that in the press. Another part of the bill that really has not gotten the kind of coverage it deserves are the massive giveaways to the nuclear industry. This bill is going to make it possible to build 6 or 7 new nuclear plants because, you know, they're not cost-effective to build without government handouts. And all in all, this bill contains about $13 billion in cradle-to-grave subsidies and tax breaks for the nuclear industry, real corporate welfare.
Now, you mentioned some of the editorials in the Post and the Times. There isn't a lot of enthusiasm for the energy bill. That doesn't mean the media have always been critical. The Washington Post editorial on July 28th says that it could have been a lot worse. The same day's New York Times editorial pointed out that it is, quote, not the unrelieved disaster some environmentalists make it out to be, close quote. It's almost as if there's some sort of fatigue that's set in. This has been fought over for way too long, and it's time to take whatever can pass and move on to another issue. Do you sense that kind of fatigue in the press or even in Congress?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we suffer from that kind of fatigue. I mean, fighting this bill, especially as it began to be evident that we were going to lose, you do suffer from fatigue. But, you know, I think that the obligation of the press is to really inform people so that they can hold their elected officials accountable. So I don't see that that's an excuse for not talking about this bill. And, you know, in a 1,700-page bill, there's always something new that can be talked about. There's always some human interest story or impact on communities or different states. There are a lot of different ways to tackle this bill besides talking about it in dry legislative ways. And so, I think it's just irresponsible not to give it the kind of coverage. I mean, when we get day in and day out of Michael Jackson and these kinds of stories, when the issues that are really going to affect people in their day-to-day lives are just let go, I mean, it's just completely irresponsible.
We've been speaking to Winona Howder of Public Citizens Critical Mass Energy and Environment Program. You can find them online at www.citizen.org. Winona Howder, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
One of the reasons we watch media consolidation with concern is that as companies get bigger, they seem to be less and less interested in serving local community needs. It was that recognition that some media power has to be kept in the community that led to the demand for so-called public access requirements for cable companies when they get those lucrative franchises. We've talked on this show about the battle to get those companies to really stick to those agreements once they've made them, but legislation now in Congress makes clear that as far as some big companies are concerned, any public interest obligation is too much. They may sound technical, but decisions being made today may not just affect the news and information you have access to tomorrow. They may usher in an era in which communities have little to say about what media they can provide their own citizens. Joining us now to fill us in on this is Anthony Riddle, Executive Director of the Alliance for Community Media. Welcome to Counterspin, Anthony Riddle.
Hello, Janine. How are you doing?
Well, not so good with this news. Sad to say, but we're going to have to assume that listeners know really probably nothing at all about these bills because, to be honest, even if they were looking for information, there's just not that much out there. So I'll ask you to break it down for us in the simplest terms. What legislation are we talking about that you think is important, and what would that legislation do?
Well, there's a ton of legislation, both at the state level in various states around the country, and more significantly right now at the federal level. There's three bills before the federal Congress, one in the House and two in the Senate. House 3146, Senate 1349, and most significantly, Senate 1504. And the reason these bills are really significant is that they're going to drastically change the way that information is received by the people at home. They essentially allow the telephone companies to come in to our communities without a franchise. They don't have to work with the local municipality to determine what the local community needs are. And there's some fairly severe limitations on the ability of the community to decide how best to use those resources that it has for communications. Essentially, we could end up with two players bringing us almost all of our information and controlling the wire that has our voice, internet, and video services, the telephone companies and the cable companies, with very little control from the community.
Well, as I said earlier, we have talked on the show about how when cable companies originally kind of negotiate those franchises, they're getting a very lucrative contract, but they're supposed to give something back in return, and that's what many listeners think of as public access. Speak a little bit about that and what the future of that looks like.
Well, a lot of people are familiar with public educational or government access, which come as a result of the franchises that the city set up, but very few people realize why they're there. The simple analogy is that if the city had a public park and everybody wanted to have lemonade in the park, then the city could let out a contract for somebody to provide lemonade. But the city also might decide that it didn't want 100 lemonade stands, and it would also decide that whoever was selling lemonade and making a profit there ought to pay back into the city something for operating on the land that the city owns. So the public right-of-ways are very much like that, meaning that the cable companies and soon to be the telephone companies possibly operate on these public right-of-ways. They have their wires and their cables and their telephone poles and whatever on the land that you and I own as citizens of the city. In return for them to be able to make the vast profits that they make operating like this, they pay some limited amount of money back to the city, about 5% is the limit, and they can also be asked to provide some communications capacity, which results in the public educational and government access channels that we see on cable, and sometimes some things that you don't see, such as institutional networks that provide communications between schools, public safety, and city institutions.
Well, realizing that the impact of these various bills will be varying and widespread, let's look just at public access. Are we really talking about its elimination?
Well, they at least make a nod to the vast organization that the Alliance and other public access users have, you know, meaning that there's about 5,000 channels nationwide. We represent over 1.2 million volunteers a year, and most people don't realize it, but public access alone produces more programming new on a weekly basis than all of the broadcasters combined, about 25,000 hours of programming a week. So, you know, some nod had to be made to that, but the way that the bills are written, the channel capacity is limited to, in many cases, less than what's already there, and the fees, the 5% that I talked about, is changed from being a user fee. In other words, you're using these public right-of-ways, so you have to pay. Instead of that, it's changed to a reimbursement for the city having to dig up the streets to put these cables and wires in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's basically going to cut out funding for PEG services, public educational and government access services. And so you may have a limited number of channels and no money to operate the facilities that support the public in being able to produce the programs.
Mm-hmm. Call me a cynic. I'm just looking ahead here. But what sorts of arguments can we expect to hear about why these changes are going to be a good thing for consumers? We know they're going to try to sell it to us somehow, and they're not going to say, hey, we're getting rid of your public access
right.
stations. What is the industry line on this?
Well, they're going to say, and you're probably sick of hearing this, that it's going to increase competition.
Mm-hmm.
It's beyond me how limiting the number of participants to two is going to increase competition. In fact, the telephone company's been saying you only have cable, broadcast, and satellite as a means of delivering video. People should have more choices, you know, meaning them. But they sort of have a history of driving everybody else out of the business as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll be saying that it's for consumer choice. And actually, I just want to pause just a little bit on that word consumer, because in all of these bills, when you look at them closely, all they ever talk about is consumers, individual consumers, you know, people who buy things, people who can be sold things. Never is the concept of citizenship listed in here. And we just believe that there ought to be a communication system that accents our citizenship, that creates a community whereby we have the means of talking to each other and identifying who we want to be as a larger community and as our local communities. And we believe these bills just leave that out.
Well, let me ask you finally what the Alliance for Community Media is doing in response to this pending legislation, and how you think folks who are concerned about it, as I know many listeners will be, can get involved.
Well, first of all, the Alliance has been organizing its membership, and we have talking points on our website, which I'll mention later. We have talking points for everybody to look at. We have sample letters, and we're getting our members to go out and talk individually to their congressional members, and even more importantly, going to their local communities, because I think a lot of the mayors, a lot of the city council people don't know that they're getting ready to lose local control over the communication systems and the public right-of-ways and the revenues that come from that. So it's a really critical issue. Just as a for instance, we were looking at the statewide bill that took place in that was in Texas, and just the amount of institutional network that was going to be lost to the public schools amounted to several hundred million dollars worth of communication services, internet services to the classroom. So even though it's not mentioned in the bills, you know, this is going to be a stress that's going to be placed on the budget there and other places if these bills go through. So we want people to contact their local officials. We have the talking points on our website if you'd like to go there. There's letters that people can look at.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Anthony Riddle, Executive Director of the Alliance for Community Media. You can catch up with their work as well as how you can get involved on these issues on their website. It's www.alliancecm.org. Thank you very much, Anthony Riddle.
Well, thanks for having us on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. And be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's program or you'd like to hear previous programs, you can find them on our website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.